Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today. My name is Skelton, Ike Skelton. I'm the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. We appreciate you being with us today. For many years, we've witnessed waste in the Department of Defense's acquisition system. We've seen it spiral out of control, placing a heavy burden on both the American taxpayers and our men and women in uniform. Less frequently, but still far too often, fraud and abuse creep into the system as well, and sadly, it happened so extensively in Iraq. Our troops rely on the acquisition system to buy the equipment they need to keep them safe on the battlefield and protect our country. When that system breaks down, they suffer. In recent years, we became increasingly concerned that this flawed defense acquisition system was not responsive enough to today's mission needs, not rigorous enough in protecting the tax dollars of millions of families who are struggling financially, and not disciplined enough in the acquisition of weapons systems for tomorrow's wars. So, in partnership with my then-ranking, John McHugh, we took action. Last year, we worked with the Senate to enact legislation to reform the weapons system acquisition. However, weapons systems make up only about 20%, a small piece of our defense acquisition spending. That bill was a great launching pad for reform, but it was just the beginning. In the House, we also created the Panel on Defense Acquisition Reform, ably led by Congressman Rob Andrews and Mike Conaway, to carry out a comprehensive review of the current system and to identify what steps we need to take to make that system work. The panel could not have done a better job. It scrutinized the defense acquisition system thoroughly. I'm downright very, very proud of that panel and the leadership of Congressman Andrews and Congressman Conaway. During the course of the past year, they held 14 hearings, two briefings on a broad range of issues with the acquisition system, unearthing everything from egregious contract fraud to simple process errors that led to billions of waste dollars. They put together an excellent report with suggestions to fix the system. We are here today to announce the introduction of the Improve Acquisition Act, legislation that would enact those recommendations from Mr. Andrews, Mr. Conaway, and their panel. Congressman Andrews and Conaway will go into more of the details of what exactly the bill does, but essentially the Improve Acquisition Act will overhaul the defense acquisition system by requiring the Department of Defense to introduce real accountability into the requirements process and create a requirements process for the acquisition of services, requiring the department to set clear objectives for the defense acquisition system and manage performance in achieving those objectives, requiring the Department of Defense to develop meaningful consequences for success or failure in the financial management, and in strengthening the industrial base to enhance competition and gain access to more innovative technology. In other words, this legislation would require the Department of Defense to adopt the basic management practices that are necessary for anything as complex as the acquisition system to function properly. These changes will make sure that the men and women who are risking their lives to protect this country are getting the proper equipment they need to do their job and to protect themselves, and that it gets to them sooner. Additionally, Mr. Andrews and I have done the math and expect the bill to prevent up to $135 billion tax savings over the next 5 years. Every day, the American families are forced to make sacrifices to make the ends meet, and it's our duty to make sure that their tax dollars are in good hands. This legislation helps us do just that. I cannot express my gratitude enough to our ranking member, Mr. McKeon, gentleman from California, for his close cooperation as well as his strong commitment to this effort. Likewise, I'm thankful for the hard work and dedication of that of our panel's members in all the work that they put into this project. Their commitment is unrivaled. With that, I turn things over to our colleague, the ranking member, gentleman from California, Buck McKeon. Mr. McKeon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank all of you for being here today. I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the considerable leadership and dedication you've shown on this front. We talk about savings in a lot of areas, and sometimes people perhaps think that we don't look at our defense spending. We do. We spend a lot of money over there, and this is an important thing that we're looking at today in ways to save and make sure that we don't have the problems that we've had in the past over there. Congressman Andrews, Congressman Conaway deserve special recognition for all the work that they've done on this effort. I commend the hard work that the HASC Defense Acquisition Reform Panel, under the leadership of Rob and Mike, have delved into in this complex world of defense acquisition. Over the last year, the panel has held more than 20 events and supported the drafting and passage of the Weapons System Acquisition Reform Act of 2009. Late last month, based on their detailed study, the panel released its final report containing recommendations and for improvements to defense acquisition. I'm proud to honor their efforts by co-sponsoring today's legislation that implements the panel's recommendations. Last year, Weapons System Acquisition Reform Act reformed the organization and processes used by the Department of Defense to manage major weapons programs, which account for approximately 20% of the Pentagon spending. This year, Rob and Mike tackled the other 80%. When you consider that 60% of the Pentagon's procurement dollars are for services contracts alone, the legislation we intend to introduce today has the potential to affect major changes at the Department of Defense and save billions of taxpayer dollars. I believe these reforms are just as important as those implemented by last year's acquisition reform legislation. First, because they address the remaining 80% of defense acquisition. But more notably, this bill is important because true reform cannot come from this institution or through legislation alone. True reform can only be accomplished by the men and women of the acquisition workforce. The bill provides tools to enhance the experience and structure of this workforce. In closing, I want to thank the dedicated men and women of the defense acquisition workforce. I commend them for their work and challenge them to fully implement these reforms, as well as others on their own initiative, to make the defense acquisition workforce the model for the rest of the department of the federal government. Reform will not be possible without them, but they hold the key to improving acquisition outcomes without falling victim to bureaucracy, a significant challenge, but one that they have our full support to carry out. With that, I'd like to introduce Rob Andrews, gentleman from New Jersey, and the chairman of the subcommittee over this great work. Thank you. Rob?
Thank you, Buck. I appreciate it. Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's my honor to be with you. Thank you for coming. And it's a special honor to serve with Chairman Ike Skelton, Ranking Member Buck McKeon. I want to thank them for giving us the opportunity to do this work and a tremendous staff of men and women to do the work for us, which they did so well. I'll say more about Mike Conaway, my friend and co-pilot, in a minute as I introduce him. But I also want to thank all the members of the panel who worked very diligently. Many of our meetings were at 8 o'clock in the morning, which around here is the middle of the night. But we wanted to do that so we would have the ability to get the uninterrupted attention of our members, and boy, they really participated. On the Democratic side, we want to thank Jim Cooper from Tennessee, Brad Ellsworth from Indiana, Joe Sestak from Pennsylvania. On the Republican side, in addition to Mr. Conaway, we want to thank Mike Kaufman from Colorado, who's with us here, and Duncan Hunter from California, who all worked very, very hard on this. Today, the Department of Defense will spend more than $1 billion buying things. And most of those things are extremely necessary and extremely appropriate for the men and women who wear the uniform of this country and defend it. Those men and women deserve the very best tools 100% of the time. But the taxpayers deserve 100 cents of value for every dollar they spend on acquiring those tools. It was our common enterprise, Republican and Democrat, to come up with a way to make sure that we move our system toward a point where we're getting 100 cents of value for every dollar that we spend. Here's some of the problems that we discovered and ran into. The Navy went to buy, was the Air Force, went to buy a refrigeration unit on a ship. They spent $32,000 for the refrigeration unit. And about 15 months later, bought the exact same thing. They spent $13,000 for a refrigeration unit. And about a year and a half later, spent $32,000 for exactly the same product. There was no evidence that there was a reason for that increase in price, but they just weren't organized, didn't have their act together. There was a contract to transport fully refined fuel products from point A to point B. The Defense Department spent $207 million out of a contemplated $221 million to move that product without a contract. They paid the money first and signed the contract second. I don't think there's an American in this country that would get their kitchen remodeled or buy a truck under those terms. You negotiate the contract first, you pay later. It usually takes 87 months for the Department of Defense to implement hardware or software and information technology. Now, anybody that uses a laptop or any teenager who uses a handheld device knows that in about 36 months, a piece of software is obsolete these days, because the computing capacity doubles about every 18 months. So you think about that. For software, for hardware that's obsolete 36 months into its life, we buy things 87 months into their life. So almost by definition, we're spending billions of dollars on obsolete information technology. So how do we go about fixing this? The first thing we do is recognize that this is not a Republican or Democratic problem. It's a common sense problem. And that's why we work together in a common sense way. The second thing you realize is that we are fortunate to have thousands of men and women in the civilian and uniform side who do an excellent job already. We need to give them the tools and the incentives to do even more. The problem here is not that you have a bunch of incompetent people working on this. The problem is we haven't given the competent people the tools and incentives they need to do the job as well as they can do it. So we don't just want to expand the procurement workforce. We want to improve it and reward it at the same time. The third idea here is that people who do good work should be rewarded for it, not with just words of praise, but with dollars of compensation. If you save a dollar for the federal government, you ought to get to keep some of that as part of your own compensation or for the team that you're on. And this incorporates that idea. Conversely, if you don't do a very good job, there should be some financial consequences to that. And there are in this bill. An idea that Mr. Conaway championed, which I think most Americans would find striking, is that most aspects of the Department of Defense don't have books that are auditable at any given time. You think about this. The FDIC requires banks to be auditable. The Department of Defense requires defense contractors to be auditable. The IRS is going to require a lot of people to be auditable probably in the next couple of months after they file their tax returns. Why should defense agencies not be held to that same standard? And because of Mr. Conaway's excellent work, frankly, career-long work in his case, that's going to happen under this bill. And finally, we recognize that our industrial base, the men and women and workers and companies that produce services and goods for the United States Department of Defense, needs to be strong. That industrial base needs to have reliable rules and reliable budgets on which they can plan and rely. We don't want to get to the point that we so often get where there's only one vendor who can compete for a job. That's not good. That's not healthy. So we want businesses large and small to be healthy and competitive so we get the best deal for our service members and the best deal for our taxpayers. I would just conclude by saying that one of the privileges of this effort in drafting this bill, this bipartisan bill, that I frankly do believe can lead us to savings, as the chairman said, in the neighborhood of $130 billion over 5 years. There's different ways to calculate that, but I think we can accomplish that. One of the pleasures has been to work in partnership with Mike Conaway. He has an accounting background, which Lord knows is needed around here, particularly on these issues. He is a person of great even temperament, great work ethic. I think one of the highest compliments I could pay in our hearings is if you came to the hearings, and a few of you did, if you came to our hearings and listened to the witnesses and the members, I don't think you could tell which was a Democrat and which was a Republican, because everybody on this panel was interested in the same goal of quality tools for our service members and full value for our taxpayers. We would not have been able to achieve this bill without the good work of my good friend, who I'd like to now introduce, Congressman Mike Conaway from Texas.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Rob. I appreciate those overly kind words. I'll try to live up to them as we go forward. I also want to thank the chairman, Ike Skelton, and ranking member Buck McKeon for entrusting Rob and I with these efforts. This is important stuff, and the chairman and the ranking member, their trust is greatly appreciated. Both of them mentioned the other panel members. I want to shout out to them as well. Jim Cooper, Brad Ellsworth, and Joe Sistak on the Democrat side, and my good friend Mike Kaufman and Duncan Hunter on our side. It really was a nonpartisan issue. We never had any kind of a conversation whatsoever that you could have listened to and said, well, that's just the Republican mantra or that's just the Democratic mantra. It really is about trying to get what's best done for our war fighters and the taxpayer, as my good colleague has said. Rob did a good job of briefly going through the bill. I want to focus on the audit issues that are still facing us. There has been in place a law that said since 1990 that said the federal government would produce auditable and audited financial statements. Every dollar that's being spent may be spent perfectly right now, but we don't know that, and we can't prove that to you, the taxpayer, that's happening. That can only get proven by having independent audits tell us that that they have systems in place that protect assets. Those systems then generate the proper reporting, that the data that the Department of Defense needs to run their business, to make decisions, to do the things that they do is accurate data, and that they can be relied upon to make good management decisions. And today that's not the case. The approach that we take under this bill is a carrot and stick kind of deal, where we say if your organization gets done early and you can be audited quicker than the 2017 deadline that's currently law, we attempted to try to move that date up because I'm a little anxious that that's way too far in the future. But as a substitute, we said if you can get your entity audited early, then there should be rewards for the entity itself. And we put in place some discretion for the undersecretary to be able to set up an incentives for the overall organization. By the same token, this will only get done by the hard work of individuals who do that work. Currently, the Corps of Engineers Civil Works Group is the only one that can be audited within the Department of Defense. It has a clean audit statement. That came as a result of hard work. It also came as a result of attention from the top, starting with the secretary and moving on down. So this bill puts in place reward opportunities for the individuals who will actually do the hard work, who will spend the extra time, will do the overtime hours, and will get it done as an incentive to help them get there. By the same token, as with the management of the broader acquisition system, if you don't get it done, then there will be penalties associated with that as well, as there must be in every other aspect of life. If we don't do the job that the taxpayer has told us that they want done, then there must be consequences for that. Sarbanes-Oxley Act from 2002, which occurred while I was in the private sector and was trying to figure out a way to deal with that, cope with that, requires that every publicly held company in this country have audited financial statements, a very strict definition. We should hold ourselves and the federal government accountable to those same standards. The Department of Defense, really no one else in government, should have a laxer standard than we require the private sector to abide by. And this bill moves us that direction. We still have a long way to go. I don't discount how hard it will be for the good men and women in the management side of business to get this done. It will require a spectacular amount of hard work and effort on their part, but that's the job we've asked them to do. That's the job they've agreed to do. And now we as taxpayer shepherds want to make sure that that gets done through this audit process, and that we have some ability to gain confidence that what we've asked them to do with the resources that we provide them. More resources on a discretionary basis go through the Department of Defense than any other entity that we have out there, because it's the single most important thing that we do is protect this country. Again, I want to thank my good colleague, Rob Andrews, who has proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that you can start hearings on time. No matter what that time, whether it's 7:30 or 8 o'clock, you can start hearings on time consistently. And when we do that, we got great work. We had a great team. It was a team effort. I also want to thank Andrew and Janice on our staff, and Serge on my personal staff, for the great work they've done and making this happen. Don't lose sight of the fact, from a staffing standpoint, that all of this hard work has happened almost the last year's bill and this year's bill in conjunction with the NDAA, which keeps the staff a little bit busy during most of the year. And so I want to thank everyone who had a hand on the staff side for just great work. So with that, I think we're ready for questions. Does everybody, you want to say something? Mike Kaufman, our colleague from Colorado, who attended most all of the hearings with us and had a particular point of view that he brought to the table, having served in Iraq as a Marine, having lived on the recipient side of much of this acquisition process, brought that that view to the table with us and made invaluable contributions to the effort. So, my good colleague Mike Kaufman from Colorado. Mike?
Thank you, Congressman Conaway, and thank you, Congressman Andrews, for your leadership on this panel. I served in both the United States Army and the Marine Corps, and I strongly believe that the legislation coming out of this panel will make our defense acquisition process more efficient and better serve the needs of the warfighter and be fair to the taxpayers who pay the bills.
Thank you very much. Questions?
We've been working this ourselves, and I will tell you that we're going to go at this two ways. One, we will have a markup on this bill singularly in the very near future, and we'll also undoubtedly make it part of the defense bill when we mark it up in May. So one way or the other, the Senate will deal with it. It's such a bipartisan effort. I have great hopes that it will come to pass and be law. Yes, sir. Let's go to the very source itself, Mr. Andrews.
Okay. Mike, you can feel free to comment. We took the draft report and had a hearing in which we had witnesses from the Defense Department come in. It was a public hearing where they made comments. We then took those comments, the staff, and I do want to mention Andrew and Janice and Kathy, Nat Bell from my office. The staff then worked with the DOD to incorporate their ideas into the final draft, and we're hopeful that there will be support for the bill. But we've actively solicited and incorporated their views.
Let me ask you one question about the culture of getting efficiency out of weapons improvement. If Congressman X has a weapon in his district that provides jobs, he's going to resist any efforts to kill it, or stretch it out, or even reform it. So, mm-hmm.
Well, we do, and that's something that the House and Senate worked together on. The President signed a tool to fix that problem last year in the major weapons systems. And the way it works, you know, the bill was sponsored by Chairman Skelton, Mr. McHugh, Senator McCain, and Senator Levin. The way it works is that if a weapons system isn't making the grade early in the process, what's called pre-milestone B, which means it's really not gotten off the ground, then the Defense Department's really under a mandate to kill it and to expose that it ought to be killed. And the reason behind this thinking is that if you nip something in the bud that doesn't work, it never reaches the point where it's got dozens of congressional districts and thousands of people working for it and develops a constituency here on the Hill. The idea really here is to take some of the worst examples of that abuse and cut them off before they ever get to be reality. Now, obviously, the jury's still out on whether that's worked because this law is less than a year old. But I believe it will. And I think that Senator McCain and Senator Levin and Chairman Skelton and then Ranking Member McHugh did a very good job in putting that together.
I can tell you that on a preliminary basis, sir, that the law that we passed previously that dealt with the larger weapon systems is being accepted well by the defense community. As Mr. Andrews says, it's still early in the process, but frankly, I'm very encouraged that it will end up working and saving a great deal of money and getting things produced on time.
I did not use the word penalty. I used the word consequence, and I think others did as well. What the bill says about this is that in taking into account which organization has which mission, the Secretary of Defense will have authority to move missions around, which means moving work around, which is a very significant consequence. I will tell you that the organized labor organizations involved have been consulted fully, have had very constructive input, and that although nothing in this bill in any way disrupts any collectively bargained rights in any way, shape, or form, I will say that there are many aspects of this bill that do introduce a new accountability system that both labor and management can and will support.
That is presently under study. I anticipate that will be part of a hearing in the near future, other than to say that we're fully aware of China's attempt to monopolize this type of material. But there are alternatives to that, and undoubtedly that will be part of a hearing in the future.
Yes, I look forward to the hearing on this. I'm concerned that we've lost a lot of our industrial base, that we've sent it overseas, that we're dependent upon other nations for things that we need that are very basic. This would be one of those. And I think we need to look at this. We need to do all we can to make sure that we're independent, that we're not dependent on other nations for our own defense. So I'm looking forward to that.
I would characterize it as very helpful and very positive. I would invite Mike to comment on this too, that what I've heard from industry is really three things. One is we want predictability. We want to know what the rules are. We want them stable so we can compete fairly. The second is wherever possible, if we can add value, we'd like multi-year contracting so that we can plan our production activities and our human resources activities in a sensible and productive way. And the third is that we want to be treated fairly and not persecuted verbally for stuff we're not responsible for. You know, one of the tricks that's usually used on these hearings and panels is to beat up on some vendor and claim that they're responsible for all these problems. We weren't interested in that 60 Minutes moment. 60 Minutes isn't here, so I'll say that. But we weren't interested in that. We were interested in the systemic issues, assets and liabilities that lead us to these problems. In many cases, I think what you'll find is it's not the companies in the industrial base that are the source of the problem. It's the set of rules that we've imposed on them that don't work very well. And I think that we try to be very responsive to that.
Let me just add one thing to that. It worked both ways. Program manager types as well. It fits in with the stability issue, and that's the funding stream stability, so that companies can know that what they contract for is going to be there, and that, you know, future acts of Congress don't get in the way of that. And we heard that from folks who are on the government side, who are responsible for supervising and dealing it, making it work. Yep. But also the vendors themselves trying to make their plans as to how they can forecast their cash flow needs as well as their to meet the contract. So that stability is we heard it loud and clear.
Let me give an actual example. I met with a very small company in my district the other day, and they were given an order that they had to go out and purchase a machine for, and then the order was stopped. Now, when you take a small company with 11 employees,
yep,
and contract with them and then change in the middle of the game, that's not fair. So it's very important that we understand fully the implications before we enter into a contract. And then once we do, we carry out the terms of that contract. Just because we're big government doesn't mean you can take advantage of smaller people, because they're all doing what they can to make our country stronger.
One last question. Yes, sir. Okay, Ron.
Mm-hmm. Actually, isn't. Nope. The procurement, as I say, averages in the neighborhood of $340 billion a year, 380, goes back and forth. We're dealing with 80% of that universe, so it's a little less than about $330 billion a year. If one projects savings in the 6 to 7% range, which I think there are lots of studies that come from RAND, that have come from CRS, that have come from GAO, that I think if you said to most people, do you think there's a dime's worth of inefficiency in the procurement system, they'd say no. We think there's 20 cents worth. We're shooting for 6 or 7 cents. Understand that 6 or 7 cents worth of efficiencies would generate that number that you talked about. There is no auditable, to quote my friend from Texas, there's no auditable way I can show that to you today. But I think that when you align incentives for people to do a good job with efficiency with their compensation, that's what you're going to produce. But that's the source of the number.
You said auditable. Who would be doing the ESCO audit? CAA, GAO?
Well, in terms of Mr. Conaway's deal?
Well, yeah. Oh, from the...
You had to do a lot of audit. There were very little audits that have been done, independent audits.
Right, that's your...
Yeah. Well, you'd have independent auditors do it. It would audit financial statements. It wouldn't be the audit themselves. So you'd have independent accounting firms who would be performing those audits on behalf of through a contract on behalf of the taxpayers.
Do we need any amount of money for that?
No, but just like every business has to come up with that expense, and it's an overhead expense, no doubt about it. The Department of Defense understands that they're going to have to live within their means, and those costs of doing business are going to be something that they're going to have to cope with and deal with. We've got the very enviable position of being able to say, it's your job, go do it, without telling them how to do that particular deal. But the cost of the back office, the cost of accounting systems, the cost of doing those kinds of things, it gets ignored many times in the private sector as well as in the government as well. But it's important, and it will lead to better decisions, better information, and better outcomes if you know that your internal controls are working properly and are being applied consistently. Then you'll be able to trust the data that you're getting out of that to make day-to-day decisions to run your business, as well as create the annual financial statements that can be audited and obtain a clean audit.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very, very much. We appreciate your being with us.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Mike.
Bob, good job.
Chairman?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Good job.
Thank you.
Way to go.
Yeah. Thank you.
Let's roll it.
Hey, just to clarify a couple of things about that, are you saying that among DOD agencies, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is the only one with a clean audit position?
As of today.
As of today? And
yeah. NRO on the... I've got this same issue with respect to the intelligence community as well. And over there, the National Reconnaissance Organization has got a clean audit as well. So they're the only one on that side.
Oh, on the intelligence side.
Right, the intelligence community.
That was the NRO.
NRO.
Yeah. Okay, and then here's the thing. At one point, you spoke about 2017 as the current deadline for DOD agencies to reach that kind of auditability standard. Elsewhere, you referred to it as their own internal deadline. Which is it? What is the law?
Law is 2017.
The law is 2017?
Yes.
But you say here...
Well, we want to encourage sooner rather than later. That's not the and so the sooner that gets done, then the advantages your work to the system.
So this isn't strictly accurate, the date the department has set for itself. It's not that you said here provide incentives.
Yeah.
It's not strictly accurate.
It's 2017. It's the law. And there's not a lot of teeth in that right now. We do add a section that says if that doesn't happen, then DOD has to show us how that gets fixed with only 1 year. But yeah, the hard deadline is 2017.
Okay, and the bit that I'm still unclear about is you spoke about if you get your entity ready even earlier, then there are incentives for the organization, and that any failure would result in, I think you said penalties, but perhaps you meant some other word. But
well, the getting it ready has two aspects. One is the entity itself would be relieved of certain administrative responsibilities that would otherwise be in place if they are audited early, and we can trust that we'll let them off the hook on a variety of issues. The undersecretary was also charged with coming up and broadening that existing structure, funding, accelerating funding and other kinds of things that would make their lives a little easier. And then on the personnel side, there would be bonus pools and other ways to incent the individuals. If it doesn't happen, then the consequences, as Rob said, and or the penalties would be laid upon the management of that organization that didn't get it done.
Consequences go to the management.
That's right.
Mr. Conway, what do you understand from the hearings that you and Congressman Andrews held about the endemic problem of the Pentagon not having auditable books? I mean, this is something that's been going on for years. It time and time again, GAO has mentioned this as a problem. How do you understand the problem?
Well, I understand the problem that they haven't gotten it done. Obviously, it's a bit frivolous, but it's about focus. It's about attention. And part of the problem is with the upper management turning over as often as it does, either at the secretary level and all through the system, you lose focus on this being an important issue. And so what I hope my colleagues and I can bring to the table is an ongoing management change to management change focus on how important this really is. And I've had this conversation with Dennis Blair on the intelligence community. I've had it with Bob Gates. There will be replacements for both of those two individuals at some time in the future. That's just how the system works. I hope I'm here to talk to the next person who takes over to make sure they are in like-minded with Dennis Blair and Bob Gates that this is important. Because unless the top guys tell the organizations, get this done, it won't happen. There's always something that can get in the way of. There's always some, the dog ate my homework. I mean, there's always something that can get in the way. And so the oversight from congressional side should be a consistent, constant theme that we bring it up. And it right now, I see that as being part of my role here in Congress with my background to continue to do that through management changes that just naturally happen within the Department of Defense at the uniform side as well as the civilian side. Now, below that tranche of appointees that come and go a little more frequently is a cadre of very capable, very strong managers, and et cetera. They need the resources, they need the leadership and the push to get this done. That group will be there over an extended amount of time, and that's the group that I hope we can work with to make sure that they see some incentives there to get it done. They would be the ones that would be beneficiaries of it. And quite frankly, if it doesn't get done, then some of that group would be the ones that will face the music if I have anything to do with it. Again, just one member of Congress. Bonus pools, pay raises, those kinds of things. You know.
Say, how you doing here? Now, personally, what I feel about this is that if I see procurement expenditures continuing to rise at the rate they are, then I won't be satisfied that this is being implemented properly. Mm-hmm. I do expect the kind of savings that we talked about here today to materialize. Mm-hmm. And it's our job as the Oversight Committee to make sure they do.
How much of this is aimed at trying to outsource, you know, services contracts. Not, I mean, you talked about 80% being services contracts, 20% being large weapons.
It's not actually. It's 80% non-large weapon systems. Part of that 80 is services, and part is hardware. But
non-large hardware being what?
Right, a truck.
Okay.
Right. If you buy a truck to carry the laundry around McGuire Air Force Base, that's not a service.
Yeah.
It's hardware, but it's not a weapon system.
Is it mostly aimed at that sort of thing, or is it
aimed at the whole thing? It's really designed to say that smart, talented people, if you give them fair metrics and compensate them if they hit them, will hit them.
Your piano no longer exists, is that correct?
That's correct.
But you will still be keeping an eye on these issues?
You bet. Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you see from the chairman and Mr. McKee, and there's at the very top of the committee, there's great interest in this. We intend to mark up this bill very soon. Hopefully, it'll be on the floor very soon, and hopefully become law in some form. And obviously, that kind of leadership of the committee indicates we'll be watching what happens. And look, that means we watch our own ideas, too. Maybe some of the things we propose won't work, in which case we have to fix them. But this is not a novel idea. Walmart is as efficient as it is, in large part because its supply chain professionals make more money if they do a good job than if they don't. It's pretty tested idea. So we just want to test it in a different
form. Here's my question for you. The Pentagon's largest single procurement project is badly off track.
Yeah.
Maybe by 90% or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, but what would you do about that?
You're referring to?
The Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35.
We didn't look at that, and I'll tell you why. I'm sorry, finish your question.
No, I'm just wondering, you know, given your approach and what you're recommending here, I'm wondering what penalties or consequences you think could or should be brought to bear in a case like this.
First of all, obviously JSF is a major weapon system,
yeah.
So it is subject to the law the president signed last May, not to this bill.
Right.
But in that idiom, secondly, what that bill is designed to do is to prevent another JSF-type fiasco.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to be honest with you, from what I know of JSF, many of the problems manifested themselves prior to Milestone B. I think this audience all knows what Milestone B is. You know, prior to Milestone B. Now, when those problems manifested themselves, if the Secretary had to live under the rules of the Waste TKO Act, he would have probably pulled the plug on big parts of JSF. When he would have done it, there would have been five companies with 600 people working on this thing, not 500 companies with 60,000 people. You understand the idea that before something builds political heft, you want to pull the plug on it. That's what the pre-Milestone B deal is about. Now, you've raised the hard question.
Mm.
Well, this all happened before Waste TKO became law. It's out there. It's probably wasted $90 billion or so, to use your number. What do you do then? I think what you do is some reconstructive surgery. And you go back and look at the requirements, and you say, this is what we really need. You figure out the parts of JSF that accomplish that, and you finish them. And you figure out the parts that don't, and you kill them. And you challenge the Congress to follow your recommendations, because that's what you need to do.
So the trick is to hit before you build. Anyone can build political heft.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right.
And that political heft typically kicks in at what point? After Milestone B?
Well,
you say?
Because remember, what Milestone B is at the point where you say, you know what, your theory worked in cyberspace. Maybe it worked as a prototype. Now let's build some of them. Once you start to build some of them, you get lots of companies, lots of people, lots of members involved, lots of subcontractors.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but let's face it, here's the way American politics works. If there's a weapons project in my district that I save, I'm a hero. But if I'm the person who kills it, I don't think anybody in my district even knows about that. So the politics is always tilted towards saving the weapons system, not killing it, even if it's a bad idea. So the idea behind the Waste TKO law of last year is to never let that process get far enough along that it builds that kind of political constituency.
Were you involved in drafting
sure.
that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That was myself and Mike. The panel had just gotten started, and we took the lead on that for the House committee along with John McHugh and the chairman.
No Mr. Today, what's the one area that you received the most pushback from the Pentagon and from the defense industry?
The financial audits. The Pentagon was nervous about the financial audits, but I think Mr. Connolly did a great job.
articulating theory in which there was some pushback about that section of the bill.
But I think Mr. Conaway
what
really...
What was their concern?
I was going to say they don't want to be audited. That's a little unfair. Their concern was that they're a different kind of organization than most people who get audited, and therefore fitting a business model wouldn't necessarily make sense and be a waste of time and money. I think Mr. Conaway and I would say, yeah, that's right, you are a different kind of business organization. That's why you need to be audited, because there aren't any real controls on what you're doing. So as far as business was concerned, I think that the proof will always be in the pudding, and there hasn't been much pushback yet, but I assure you, the first time that it's discovered that purchasing cases of water, you know, in some really expensive local parochial way doesn't make sense, there'll be pushback from the people selling the cases of water. You can count on that. But we think that you need to do it anyway. You need to get the best value.
Mr. Andrews, a real quick question. Buy-in from Secretary Gates and the president?
I would certainly hope we're going to accomplish that. Thus far, here's what we know. The draft report was reviewed by the Department of Defense. We had a public hearing with witnesses from the department. They were generally favorable. They had some things they wanted changed. We changed them. Obviously, they have to read the bill, but I'm very hopeful we'll have their support.
Okay.